You left it barely 12 pages from the end. In that time, over 10 years have elapsed at Thornfield, time enough for much planning.
Thornfield?
Rebuilt, yes. My husband retired, and he and I manage the house these days. None of it is mentioned in the book, and Mrs. Rochester aims to keep it that way. Much more pleasant than Osaka, and certainly more rewarding than the tourist business.
There didn't seem much I could say.
Mrs. Jane Rochester asked Mrs. Nakajima to bring me here to assist, said Mr. Briggs simply. She and Mr. Rochester were eager to help you as you helped them. They wish you all happiness and health for the future, and thank you for your timely intervention.
I smiled.
How are they?
Oh, they're fine, miss, replied Briggs happily. Their firstborn is now 5, a fine, healthy boy, the image of his father. Jane produced a beautiful daughter this spring gone past. They have named her Helen Thursday Rochester.
I looked across at Landon, who was standing at the entrance to the church and trying to explain to his Aunt Ethel what was going on. I must speak to him. But I was talking to myself. Mrs. Nakajima and the solicitor had gone, melted back to Thornfield to report to Jane and Edward on a job well done. As I approached, Landon sat on the church steps, took out his carnation, and sniffed at it absently.
Hello, Landon.
Landon looked up and blinked.
Ah, he said. Thursday. I might have known.
May I join you?
Be my guest.
I sat down next to him on the warm limestone steps. He stared straight ahead.
Was this your doing? He asked at last.
No, indeed, I replied. I confess I came here to interrupt the wedding, but my nerve failed me. He looked at me.
Why?
Why? Well, because I thought I'd make a better Mrs. Park Lane than Daisy, I suppose.
I know that, exclaimed Landon, and agree wholeheartedly. What I wanted to know is why your nerve failed you. After all, you chase after master criminals, indulge in high-risk spec-ops work, will quite happily go against orders to rescue comrades under an intense artillery barrage, yet...
I get the point. I don't know. Maybe those sorts of yes-or-no life-and-death decisions are easier to make, because they are so black and white. I can cope with them because it's easier. Human emotions, well, they're just a fathomless collection of greys, and I don't do so well on the mid-tones.
Mid-tones is where I've lived for the past 10 years, Thursday.
I know, and I'm sorry. I had a lot of trouble reconciling what I felt for you and what I saw as your betrayal of Anton. It was an emotional tug of war, and I was the little pocket handkerchief in the middle, tied to the rope, not moving.
I loved him too, Thursday. He was the closest thing to a brother that I ever had, but I couldn't hang on to my end of the rope forever.
I left something behind in the Crimea, I murmured. But I think I've found it again. Is there time to try and make it all work?
Bit 11th hour, isn't it? He said with a grin.
No, I replied. More like 3 seconds to midnight. He kissed me gently on the lips. It felt warm and satisfying, like coming home to a roaring log fire after a long walk in the rain. My eyes welled up, and I sobbed quietly into his collar as he held me tightly.
"Excuse me," said the vicar, who had been lurking close by. "I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I have another wedding to perform at 3:30."
We muttered our apologies and stood up. The wedding guests were still waiting for some sort of decision. Nearly all of them knew about Landon and me, and few, if any, thought Daisy a better match.
"Will you?" asked Landon in my ear.
"Will I what?"
I asked, stifling a giggle.
"Fool, will you marry me?"
"Hmm,"
I replied, heart thumping like the artillery in the Crimea.
"I'll have to think about it."
Landon raised a quizzical eyebrow.
"Yes, yes, yes, I will. I will with all my heart."
"At last," said Landon with a sigh. "The lengths I have to go to get the woman I love."
We kissed again, but for longer this time. So long, in fact, that the vicar, still staring at his watch, had to tap Landon on the shoulder.
"Thank you for the rehearsal," said Landon, shaking the vicar vigorously by the hand. "We'll be back in a month's time for the real thing."
The vicar shrugged. This was fast becoming the most ludicrous wedding of his career.
"Friends," announced Landon to the remaining guests, "I would like to announce the engagement of myself to this lovely Spec Ops agent named Thursday next. As you know, she and I have had our differences in the past, but they are now quite forgotten. There is a marquee at my house stuffed with food and drink, and I understand Holroyd Wilson will be playing from 6 o'clock onwards. It would be a crime to waste it all, so I suggest we just change the reason."
There was an excited yell from the guests as they started to organise transport for themselves. Landon and I went in my car, but we drove the long way round. We had plenty to talk about, and the party, well, it could continue without us for a while. The celebrations didn't finish until 4 a.m. I drank too much and took a cab back to the hotel. Landon was all for me staying the night, but I told him slightly coquettishly that he could wait until after the wedding. I vaguely remember getting back to my hotel room, but nothing else. It was blackness until the phone rang at 9 the following morning. I was half-dressed, Pickwick was watching breakfast TV, and my head ached like it was fit to burst. It was Victor. He didn't sound in a terribly good mood, but politeness was one of his stronger points. He asked me how I was. I looked at the alarm clock as a hammer banged inside my head.
I've been better. How are things at work?
Not brilliant, replied Victor with a certain reserve in his voice. The Goliath Corporation want to speak to you about Jack's shit, and the Bronte Federation are hopping mad over the damage to the book. Was it absolutely necessary to burn Thornfield to the ground?
That was Hades. And Rochester, blinded and with a shattered hand? I suppose that was Hades too?
Well, yes.
This is the mother of all balls-ups, Thursday. You'd better come in and explain yourself to these Bronte people. I've got their special executive committee with me, and they are not here to pin a medal on your chest.
There was a knock at the door. I told Victor I would be in directly, and got unsteadily to my feet.
Hello?
I called out.
Room service, replied a voice outside the door. Mr. Park Lane rang in some coffee for you.
Hang on, I said, as I tried to shoo Pickwick back into the bathroom. The hotel had strict rules about pets. Unusually for him, he seemed slightly aggressive. If he had possessed any wings, he would probably have flapped them angrily.
This is no time to be a pest, I grunted as I pushed the recalcitrant bird into the bathroom and locked the door.
I held my head for a moment as it thumped painfully, wrapped myself in a dressing gown, and opened the door.
Big mistake.
There was a waiter there, but he wasn't alone. As soon as the door was fully open, two other men in dark suits entered and pressed me against the wall with a gun to my head.
You're going to need another 2 cups if you want to join me for coffee, I groaned. Very funny, said the man dressed as the waiter.
Goliath?
In one.
He pulled back the hammer on the revolver.
Gloves are off next. Shit is an important man and we need to know where he is. National security and the Crimea depend upon it, and one lousy officer's life isn't worth diddly shit when you look at the big picture.
I'll take you to him, I gasped, trying to give myself some breathing space. It's a little way out of town.
The Goliath agent relaxed his grip and told me to get dressed. A few minutes later, we were walking out of the hotel. My head was still sore, and a dull pain thumped in my temples, but at least I was thinking more clearly. More crowd ahead of me, and I was delighted to see it was the Mutler family preparing to return to London. Daisy was arguing with her father, and Mrs. Mutler was shaking her head wearily.
"Gold digger!" I yelled.
Daisy and her father stopped arguing and looked at me as the Goliath men tried to steer me past.
"What did you say?"
"You heard. I can't think who the bigger tart is, your daughter or your wife."
It had the desired effect. Mr. Mutler turned an odd shade of crimson and threw a fist in my direction. I ducked, and the blow struck one of the Goliath men fairly and squarely on the jaw. I bolted for the car park. A shot whistled over my shoulder. I jinked and stepped into the road as a big black military-style Ford motor car screeched to a halt.
"Get in!" shouted the driver.
I didn't need to be asked twice. I jumped in, and the Ford sped off as 2 bullet holes appeared in the rear windshield.
The car screeched round the corner and was soon out of range. "Thanks," I murmured. "Any later and I might have been worm food. Can you drop me at Spec Ops HQ?" The driver didn't say anything. There was a glass partition between me and him, and all of a sudden I had that out of the frying pan and into the fire feeling. "You can drop me anywhere," I said. He didn't answer. I tried the door handles, but they were locked. I thumped on the glass, but he ignored me. We drove past the Spec Ops building and headed off to the old town. He was driving fast, too. Twice he went through a red light, and once he cut up a bus. I was thrown against the door as he flew around a corner, just missing a brewer's dray. "Here, stop this car!" I shouted, banging again on the glass partition. The driver simply accelerated, clipping another car as he took a corner a little too fast. I pulled hard at the door handles and was about to use my heels against the window when the car abruptly screeched to a halt. I slid off the seat and collapsed in a heap in the footwell. The driver got out, opened the door for me and said, "There you go, missy. Didn't want you to be late. Colonel Phelps' orders." "Colonel Phelps?" I stammered. The driver smiled and saluted briskly as the penny dropped. Phelps had said he would send a car for me to appear at his talk. And he had. I looked out of the door. We had pulled up outside Swindon Town Hall, and a vast crowd of people were staring at me. "Hello, Thursday," said a familiar voice. "Lydia," I asked, caught off guard by the sudden change of events. And so it was. But she wasn't the only TV news reporter. There were six or seven of them with their cameras trained on me as I sat, sprawled inelegantly, in the footwell. I struggled to get out of the car. "This is Lydia Startwright of the Toad News Network," said Lydia in her best reporter's voice. "Here with Thursday Next, the Spec Ops agent responsible for saving Jane Eyre. First, let me congratulate you, Miss Next, on your successful reconstruction of the novel." "What do you mean?" I responded. "I loused it all up. I burned Thornfield to the ground and half maimed poor Mr. Rochester." Miss Startwright laughed. "In a recent survey, 99 out of 100 readers who expressed a preference said they were delighted with the new ending. Jane and Rochester married. Isn't that wonderful?"
"But the Bronte Federation..."
"Charlotte didn't leave the book to them, Miss Next," said a man dressed in a linen suit who had a large blue Charlotte Bronte rosette stuck incongruously to his lapel. "The Federation are a bunch of stuffed shirts. Allow me to introduce myself. Walter Bramwell, chairman of the Federation splinter group, Bronte for the People." He thrust out a hand for me to shake and grinned wildly as several people nearby applauded. A battery of flash guns went off as a small girl handed me a bunch of flowers and another journalist asked me what sort of a person Rochester really was. The driver took my arm and guided me into the building. "Colonel Phelps is waiting for you, Miss Next," murmured the man in an affable tone. The crowds parted as I was led into a large hall that was filled to capacity. I blinked stupidly and looked around. There was an excited buzz, and as I walked down the main aisle, I could hear people whispering my name. There was an improvised press box in the old orchestra pit, in which a sea of pressmen from all the major networks were seated. The meeting at Swindon had become the focus of the grassroots feeling about the war. What was said here would be highly significant. I made my way to the stage, where two tables had been set up. The two sides to the argument were clearly delineated. Colonel Phelps was sitting beneath a large English flag. His table was heavily festooned with bunting and several pot plants, flip-over pads and stacks of leaflets for ready distribution. With him were mostly uniformed members of the armed forces who had seen service on the peninsula. All of them were willing to speak vociferously about the importance of the Crimea. One of the soldiers was even carrying the new plasma rifle. At the other end of the stage was the anti-table. This, too, was liberally populated by veterans, but none of them wore uniforms. I recognised the two students from the airship park and my brother Joffy, who smiled and mouthed, "Watch her, doofus," at me. The crowd hushed. They had heard I was going to attend and had been awaiting my arrival. The cameras followed me as I approached the steps to the stage and walked calmly up. Phelps rose to meet me, but I walked on and sat down at the ante-table, taking the seat that one of the students had given up for me.
Phelps was appalled. He went bright red.